This week, in an all-new Masonic Mythbusters, Worshipful Brother Patrick Day takes on the five orders in architecture. How many times have you listened to a lecture in masonry and thought, well, that doesn't quite sound right? Well, Patrick Day has definitely had that moment. We'll hear all about it in this week's Masonic Mythbusters. Then, we'll have a book review on a new book about the moon and its relationship to us, which we might be considered her children. We'll wrap it up with a piece from Brent S. Morris, published on MasonicWorld.com, called Albert Pike and Lucifer, The Lie That Will Not Die. He gives us some reaffirming facts that we can take into our personal arsenal the next time we are accosted by anyone who says Freemasons are evil. All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode number 626. In the news, lots of awesome new presentation dates are coming up. I need to update the website, but suffice to say, I will be all over the United States and a little bit of international travel this year. I'll make sure I put up everything in our schedule on WCYpodcast.com. Right away, I want to thank our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners of the WCY Podcast. Without you, we can't make this show, and I really appreciate all of you. If you are curious on how you can help support the WCY Podcast, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and check out the various options. And just as a reminder, everything that we offer, all of the links, anything that gets sold through WCY Media or our Patreon or anything, all that comes right back to the financial support of this show. All right. As you heard in the top of the program, we got a great new Masonic Mythbusters with Worshipful Brother Patrick Day. Now, this week, I mentioned a little bit about what he's talking about. And as you all may or may not know, I too am a bit of a stickler when it comes to details. In fact, something that Patrick says in this piece really resonates with me, and it might resonate with you. Let's dive in and check out this awesome new segment.
In a digital landscape filled with historical inaccuracy, out-of-context quotes on memes and soundbites, there is an epidemic of fraternal occult, mythological, and historical misinformation. It's time to set the record straight. Masonic Mythbusters with Patrick Day.
So, I am quite the pedant, which should be obvious at this point. I mean, I've done, 15 of these myth-busting pieces? I will nitpick things to hell and back. Now with that out of the way, I'm going to nitpick something from Masonic ritual that annoys me to no end for being blatantly erroneous. It is the portion of the stair lecture concerning the orders of architecture, namely, who invented them. And they annoy me as someone who has a master's of architecture and was formally trained in classical architecture, design, and history. Someone who has professionally worked in architecture for almost a decade, and overall has a passion for architectural history and theory. I know the wording will differ from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but for the most part, most jurisdictions in the U.S. use the Preston Webb lecture system, first produced by William Preston in his Illustrations of Masonry, and later reproduced in the United States by Thomas Webb as The Monitor. Most jurisdictions' rituals I have either witnessed or viewed more or less say the same thing. The Ionic, Doric, and Corinthian are the most ancient and were invented by the Greeks, while the Tuscan and Composite were contrived by the Romans. Thus says Preston, and he's wrong. Now, I'm going to forgive the attribution of the Doric, Ionic, and Corinthian to the Greeks, because when they developed those orders, they were not Greeks. There really wasn't even a Pan-Hellenic League yet. It was just a bunch of city-states with loosely defined regions of common Hellenic races. The Doric was developed from earlier wood forms, which were likely inspired by Egyptian architecture, as there was commercial trade between the two regions, and was largely found in regions of Dorian city-states. The Ionic technically isn't Greek, even by the later Romans, who called Ionia Anatolia. The Ionians are distinctly a different race that it takes some effort to argue they were Greeks. Yes, the Ionians would join the Panhellenic League, but they're Ionians. They are really only considered Greek owing to their joining the alliance against Persian invasions. And the Corinthian, well, that's a city. That's not a Hellenic race. And technically, the Corinthians were Dorians. We can actually see how these three orders were used in racial alliances or omitted out of racism. For instance, in Sparta, you don't see Ionic columns around the 5th century BCE. Because the Spartans hated the Ionians for surrendering to the Persians so easily. But the Spartans, that virile culture of warriors, they loved the dainty, girly Corinthian order because, well, Corinth is a Dorian city. Albeit the Corinthian order wasn't developed for another century after the alliance was formed. On the other hand, in Athens, where the Panhellenic League was being promoted, they loved to include the Ionic order because they wanted the Ionians represented in their alliance. But these so-called Greek orders are really loosely lumped together because a much later alliance between city-states during the Greco-Persian Wars. That pedantry aside, what I take issue with is the particular wording of the Tuscan and composite were contrived by the Romans. No, not even close. Firstly, the Tuscan was invented by the Etruscans. Preston actually acknowledges this in his explanation of the Tuscan order. Though more often than not, I find this portion is usually omitted in many U.S. jurisdictions, which annoys me because it was invented by the Etruscans. That's why it's called the Tuscan. It's in the name. Now, the various Hellenic races certainly had trade with the Etruscans on the Italian peninsula, but we find examples of the Tuscan earlier than trade between the two cultures. In fact, the Tuscan and Doric orders appear to have been developed around the same time independently. One possibility is that the Egyptians influenced both cultures independently. And whatever the case, the Tuscan is equally as old as the Doric and was not contrived by the Romans, but rather, it was invented by the Etruscans. They're not the same thing. What we call Roman is really a blending of Etruscan and Greeks at a later time. I also hate the use of that word contrived. It implies that they just made it up capriciously on a whim. It denounces the architectonics of the development of the Tuscan and Doric orders as logical forms of wood construction that was later replicated in stone. It implies the Romans saw the Doric and whimsically said to themselves, let's do that, but more simple. Why? I don't know. I just thought it'd look cool. It effaces from masonry the long-known archaeological understanding of Etruscan culture, temple building, and building techniques. Even Andrea Palladio, the famed Venetian architect, who himself was an operative stonemason, he actually even had a portrait of himself made with the square and compasses in front of him. He was one of our operative brethren. He knew well Etruscan construction methods and why the Tuscan is just as valid as the Doric. Now moving on. Then there's the composite. It's hard to argue that this order was contrived by the Romans when you know how it came to be. I mean, yes, the composite was developed by the Romans, but only as a particularly Roman variation of the Corinthian. The reality is that the Corinthian is a very interpretive order. All the orders are open to interpretation and variation. There are rules for their composition, but they are flexible. and the Corinthian in particular has a great deal of variation. Do something for me. Look up a picture of the Corinthian order used on the Tower of the Winds in Athens. Yeah, that's a very different looking Corinthian. It is so unique that this Corinthian style is specifically called the Tower of the Winds Corinthian. Now look up a picture of the first known Corinthian capital, the one from the Temple of Apollo at Bassae. Yeah, it's weird looking. Heck, look at the Ionics at the Temple of Apollo at Bassae. Yeah, those are weird too. Compare those to their predecessor, the Aeolian Order. Oh yeah, there's another order that Masonic lectures don't mention. I guess Renaissance architects thought five orders was a nice number and didn't bother with the Aeolian. Check out a picture of the Corinthian order as used on the Temple of Mars Uxor. What's that? They used Pegasus instead of plants? Yeah, the orders are open to interpretation and artistic flourishing. And the composite is just a Roman variation of the Corinthian. Let's try something. Take a look at the composite and the Corinthian and tell me the difference between them. Like, could you pull up a picture of one and identify it as either the composite or the Corinthian with certainty? I know many architects that cannot tell the difference. I mean, sometimes I even second guess myself, and I was trained in this. This is because the composite was not a separate order from the Corinthian until the Renaissance. If you read Vitruvius' 10 books on architecture, you'll notice he never brings up the composite. He expends quite a bit of ink and paper on the Doric and the Ionic, and then he spends a lot of time with the Corinthian, like a lot of time. Then he gives the Tuscan order a little short byline, but no composite. That's because it didn't exist. It was just the Corinthian in a distinctly Roman manner. Now, how did it become a separate order? Well, it starts with a misunderstanding of other Renaissance architects who were reading Leon Battista Alberti's 10 books on the art of building, in which he makes note of an Italic order, which is sometimes translated as Roman order. In particular, Alberti appears to be noting the peculiar Corinthian orders used on the Arch of Titus, as well as the Arch of Septimius Servius, which he notes as the Italic order he uses on his design of the Tempio Malatestiano in Rimini, Italy. Well, no one knew exactly what Alberti meant by Italic order. Most architects at the time would have just said, well, that's just the Corinthian. Now, the architect Serlio would take Alberti to mean that this is a separate order, rather than a Roman variation of the Corinthian. But Serlio goes a bit further by claiming it is a composite of the other orders, and adds it as the fifth canon of architecture, the composite order. Way to go, Serlio. Now, don't get me wrong, I love Serlio. Have you ever heard of Palladian windows? Yeah, even though it is named after Palladio, it was actually originally invented by Serlio. He was very important to the establishment of Renaissance architecture, and he is certainly equally as influential as Alberti, but I think he took Alberti a little too literally, or he just really wanted five orders because he liked that number, or something. And everyone followed his example, and we still today class the composite as a separate order. And we really can't do much about it anymore. It's just part of the canon of architecture. And when I give a stair lecture, I deliberately switch up the wording to be a little bit more accurate. And anyone who corrects me proceeds to get a separate lecture on archaeological and architectural history and theory. Brothers sometimes even ask me if I'm going to do it the right way or the Patrick way. Oh, I get it. You know, I get guys tell me that you're not supposed to innovate upon masonry, etc. Well, the ritual is wrong. It's not an innovation, it's a correction. Since when did our ritual become the infallible word of God? And given my love of architectural history and theory, try and stop me. Now, what's the wording I propose and I use? The Ionic, Doric, and Corinthian are the most ancient and were invented by the Greeks. The Tuscan was invented by the Etruscan, and the composite was developed by the Romans. Or at least that's a good compromise. In reality, if I had it my way, it would be the Ionic, Doric, and Corinthian were developed at different times of great antiquity by various Hellenic races that we now call the Greeks. The Tuscan is just as old as the Doric and was invented by the Etruscans. The composite was developed by the Romans and erroneously interpreted as a separate order from the Corinthian during the Renaissance. And let's pretend the Aeolic order doesn't exist.
Alright, how about that? A wonderful piece by Worshipful Brother Day. And as he jokes in the beginning of it, you know, he is always about the details. And he's always about trying to be accurate. What was the part I mentioned about possibly resonating with me and might resonate with you? It is the idea that corrections rather than innovations are being done. I often have done something similar, not with architecture, but perhaps with some other characters within degrees like Pythagoras and Eureka and things of that nature. But in any case, this was fantastic. We've got much more coming with Masonic Mythbusters. Brother Day has got lots of good stuff in store for us, so stay tuned. But next up, let's get into something from Science News. You can categorize this one under astronomy. So this is going to be a book review, which again was published on sciencenews.org by Sheehan Kim, and it was published earlier this month on February 8th. The book in question, called Our Moon, is by Rebecca Boyle, and it's published by Random House, but I thought this was very interesting considering our call to study those seven liberal arts and sciences. As we've talked about before, we read pieces that fit under those seven liberal arts from time to time. We'll put a link to the book in the show notes. How Our Moon Shaped Life on Earth and Human History. Rebecca Boyle's wide-ranging book celebrates our celestial companion. Science journalist Rebecca Boyle has an intergenerational connection with the moon. Her grandfather, Professor John C. Corcoran, was involved in the 1943 Battle of Tarawa on the namesake atoll in the Pacific Ocean during World War II. The United States' narrow victory against Japan came at heavy human cost. One reason? A weak high tide forced American soldiers to wade through the ocean into Japanese gunfire, rather than sail their boats to meet their enemies. Historians blame the moon for the massive casualties. The battle occurred during a time of the month when the sun's and the moon's gravitational tugs partially cancel each other out, contributing to the lower-than-usual high tide. Boyle, however, recognizes that the moon's impact on humankind is far more vast and multifaceted. After all, the moon helped shape Earth into the home we know, she writes in her new book, Our Moon. At the outset, Boyle promises to convince readers of the moon's extensive influences, both biological and spiritual. Over nearly 300 pages, she delivers. Naturally, the book touches on well-known subjects, including the Apollo missions that brought humans to the lunar surface. Still, the book is guaranteed to surprise, filled with factoid gold that will enthrall geologists, moon nerds, and casual readers alike. For instance, Boyle incorporates new research on how the moon formed 4.5 billion years ago, pointing to geologic evidence that may still be entombed deep within Earth's mantle. And contrary to what Apollo photos suggest, the moon's surface sparkles with technicolor hues, astronauts reported. The moon was not gray, but a landscape flecked with color, Boyle writes. Quote, analysis of the moon rocks has since found volcanic gas in every color of the spectrum, end quote. And then there are the ways the moon has influenced life on Earth. The tides pulled our ocean, confined ancestors, out of the water. Extremes between high and low tides in the distant past kept beaching marine life. Those that could breathe in air or developed limbs for walking became the earliest landlubbers. Acting as a mini counterweight to Earth's own heft, the moon has kept our planet's axis from lurching all over the place, thereby preventing extreme climate swings over millennia. The moon also inspired the first religions, and its study spawned the first science. Boyle packs an impressive amount of information, but instead of throwing details at the reader, she packages them into imagined experiences of a lunar visitor. The result is a rich travelogue that makes the moon's sensations visceral down to its acrid smell and the hay fever you'd get from exposure to pesky lunar dust. Early humans brought the distant moon down to the Earth through patient observation and art. Now Boyle brings readers up there. With much ground to cover, she divides the book into three sections: the moon's making, its cultural footprint, and how modern society recast the moon in a new light. Rather than adhering to a strict chronology, Boyle roams under these three broad umbrellas. Her discussions within each section come in palatable bites and sizes and swing between the ancient and modern culture and science. The masterful weaving is on display when Boyle recounts the moon's role in keeping track of time. Quote unquote, "Time confers power to whoever commands it," she writes, "and it remains the simplest and most predictable way to seize that command. Stone Age Scots, Mesopotamians, and Native Americans understood the power of the lunar cycles, and they erected monuments to track the moon's trek across the sky. But around 45 BCE, Julius Caesar designed a calendar that banished the moon from its timekeeping duties. Now society mostly looks to the sun as our daily metronome. Today, we're at another juncture where the moon might further drop from its standing of reverence and communion. Soon, astronauts will return there with the United States, China, and other countries scoping out the landing sites. Instead of being endeavors for the benefit of all humankind, these explorations will probably be nationalistic race for scientific real estate," Boyle warns. "Our heavenly neighbor is also being eyed as a mining outpost, a junkyard, a way station for deep space travel, or a settlement destination. The moon," she writes, "may fall into the ravenous maw of capitalism. Still, the moon is more than just another target for humankind's material ambitions. Our moon reminds us that our silver sister has given us our habitable climate, sciences, and cultures. These gifts are more than enough. They are priceless." You can buy the book, Our Moon, from bookshop.org. Science News is again a bookshop.org affiliate, and will earn a commission on those purchases made from the link in this article. And that will be the link that I will post so that you can pick it up. Since we are borrowing an article from their site, it's only right to be able to do that. And so, as I read this book review, it's definitely a book I think I'm going to go ahead and pick up, but I had to laugh at this idea of the moon falling into the ravenous maw of capitalism, she says. And this is interesting because, and both funny, like I said, if you've ever seen Futurama, there's an episode where Fry decides to go to the moon and is overwhelmed with a Disney-like atmosphere, if you will. If the listeners out there have any great books about the moon or space travel or anything like that you'd like to recommend, feel free to throw those into the Craftsman Plus Facebook group. I will share a couple of my favorite space books there as well, and I will link them. Next up, we've got a piece that came from Brent S. Morris, published on MasonicWorld.com, and it's called Albert Pike and Lucifer, The Lie That Will Not Die. Now, in the past on the WCY podcast, we've done runs of episodes reading various pieces regarding Albert Pike, his history, his writing, and all of that. I thought it would be a fun idea and adventure to read this one, Albert Pike and Lucifer, The Lie That Will Not Die, by S. Brent Morris, past master, and of course you all know him from the ancient and accepted Scottish Rite, all of his books and amazing things that he's done for the craft. And again, something that we all know, Albert Pike, cool, but what about this Lucifer thing and Leo Taxol and all of that stuff? Now, we've covered him as well, but never from Brent S. Morris. So let's check this piece out. Have you ever heard the sad story about the dog that someone tried to dry off in a microwave oven? What about the one where a jealous husband poured concrete into a new convertible, not realizing it was a surprise anniversary gift from his wife? Or maybe you've read about Albert Pike's so-called Luciferian doctrine. which teaches Masons that Lucifer is God. These stories have one thing in common. They're all false. The first two are harmless urban myths, innocently retold as cautionary tales. The story about Albert Pike and Lucifer, however, is a lie that will not die. Gabriel Antoine Jugon Pages, writing as Leo Taxel, conceived the hoax and designed it to slander Freemasonry and to embarrass the Catholic Church. It has been repeated for a century by anti-Masons who accept, with childlike eagerness, any slur against our gentle craft. No other lie has captured the imagination of anti-Masons quite like this Leo Taxel hoax, just one of many he perpetrated against Freemasonry and the Catholic Church. Once our critics have twisted logic to convince themselves that Freemasonry is the work of Satan, they are ready to accept this perversion. It usually comes in the form of a quotation that starts, quote, "On July 14, 1889, Albert Pike, Sovereign Pontiff of Universal Freemasonry, addressed the 23 Supreme Confederate Councils of the World the following instructions." That is all you need to read to know the author has fallen prey to this infamous hoax. It is not entirely certain when this quote was fabricated, nor when it was first published. We can, however, trace its modern appearances to Edith Starr Miller, who wrote Occult Theocracy in 1933 under the pen name Lady Queensborough. Her work is excerpted and treated as the gospel truth, usually without attribution. Such practices are known as plagiarism in other disciplines, but neither serious research nor intellectual integrity stand in the way of a headlong rush to slander Freemasonry. Miss Miller found her quote in the 1894 book by Abe Clarin de la Rive, Women and Child in Universal Freemasonry. Abbe de la Rive, like Miss Miller, was duped by the hoax. They are guilty only of incompetent research and an eager willingness to believe the worst about Freemasonry. The ultimate source was the pornographer, anti-Mason and anti-Catholic, Leo Taxel, again Gabriel Antoine Jugon Pages. Taxel publicly confesses his deception in 1897, and his story is widely available for anyone willing to look for the truth. Just a few of the many references are listed below. The New Catholic Encyclopedia, Henry W. Coyle, Great Soviet Encyclopedia, 3rd edition, Arthur Edward Waite's New Encyclopedia of Freemasonry, the list goes on. The entire passage from Miss Miller is not worth quoting, though we will give the portion most repeated. The bogus Luciferian doctrine of Albert Pike from Edith Starr Miller, Lady Queensborough, from the Occult Theocracy in 2 volumes, 1933 reprint by the Christian Book Club of America. Page 233. De la Rive states that on July 14, 1889, Albert Pike, Sovereign Pontiff of Universal Freemasonry, addressed to the 23 Supreme Confederated Councils of the World the following instructions, which we quote herewith in part. Page 220. "That which we must say to the crowd is, we worship a God, but it is the God that one adores without superstition. To you, Sovereign Grand Inspectors General, we say this, that you may repeat it to the brethren of the 32nd, 31st, and 30th degrees. The Masonic religion should be, by all of its initiates of the higher degrees, maintained in the purity of the Luciferian doctrine. If Lucifer were God, would Adonai, the God of the Christians, whose deeds prove his cruelty, perfidy, and hatred of man, barbarism, and repulsion for science, would Adonai and his priests calumniate him? Thus, the doctrine of Satanism is heresy, and the true and pure philosophic religion is the belief in Lucifer, the equal of Adonai, but Lucifer, God of light and God of good, is struggling for humanity against Adonai, the God of darkness and evil." There are several problems with this quotation, some obvious, some subtle. To start with, about 1 million out of 2.5 million American Masons have the 32nd degree in the Scottish Rite, including ministers, rabbis, bishops, and other devout worshippers of God. It is inconceivable that there would not be mass resignations if these men were taught this disgusting Luciferian doctrine. It's unbelievable that millions of Scottish Rite Masons during the last two centuries could be cowed into such total silence. The quote is riddled with logical inconsistencies. There was no position of sovereign pontiff of universal Freemasonry. There is no confederation of supreme councils. In the United States, virtually all Scottish Rite Masons receive the 32nd degree. So why would Albert Pike suggest special treatment for 30th degree, 31st degree, and 32nd degree Masons, when that would have included everyone? The real evidence of a hoax comes in De La Rive's footnote, which neither Miss Miller nor anyone else bothers to quote. It refers to Diana Vaughan, the matchless creation of Leo Taxil's twisted mind. The footnote and translation are printed below. For this, I will read only the translation. It was the sister Diana Vaughan that Albert Pike, in order to give her the greatest mark of confidence, charged to carry his Luciferian encyclical to Paris during the Universal Exposition. The Diana Vaughan hoax is well known and has been explained time and time again for nearly a century. Here's what the New Catholic Encyclopedia has to say about Leo Taxil. Taxil purported to reveal the existence of Palladium, the most secret Masonic order, which practiced devil worship. He recounted the story of its high priestess, Diana Vaughan, and ended by publishing the memoirs after her conversion to Catholicism. When doubts began to spread, Taxil realized the time had come to end the deceit. In a conference in Paris on April 19, 1897, he cynically admitted his hoax, whose aim, he said, was to hold up Catholicism to derision. After Taxil's public confession, Abbé de la Rive expressed his disgust and recanted his writings on Diana Vaughan in the April 1897 issue of Freemasonry Disclosed, a magazine devoted to the destruction for the craft. As much as he hated Freemasonry, de la Rive had the integrity to admit Taxil's hoax. After Taxil's public confession, Taxil declared before an assembly especially convened for him that for 12 years he had carried out to the end the most extraordinary and most sacrilegious of hoaxes. We have always been careful to publish special articles concerning Palladism and Diana Vaughan. We are now giving in this issue a complete list of these articles which can now be considered as not having existed. Quoted in Alex Milner's Strange Masonic Stories. Anyone interested in the plain truth can easily discover the story of Leo Taxil. Recent critics of Masonry, however, are not interested in simple facts. These detractors have convinced themselves that Freemasonry is the work of the devil. Thus, they apparently justify their perversions with the thought that they are doing the Lord's work, saving an unsuspecting world from Satan. No misquotation, no distortion, no lie is too great if it accomplishes what they perceive as their holy mission. This includes gleefully perpetuating the bogus Luciferian doctrine of Albert Pike. All this is done in the name of Him who said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." Freemasonry teaches its members tolerance, even of its assailants. If you are presented with a story of Pike and Lucifer, quietly but firmly state it's a lie. Don't let it pass without comment, but don't provoke an argument. The truth is on our side. But remember the words attributed to Edmund Burke: the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. Love this piece. I love that he kind of glossed over most of it for us and gave us a sort of reaffirming back pat, if you will, that the truth will win. And even today, on several of our YouTube videos, we get people commenting, "Repent, you know, you're going to go to hell," and all of this nonsense. And it's quite amazing that it still lives on today, and I'm sure many of you have felt the same. If you've got any crazy stories, feel free to share them with us. With that, we're going to wrap it up. And so one more time, I want to thank those producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners of the WCY podcast. Again, without you, this show doesn't happen. And if you're curious on how you can support the WCY podcast, head on over to the website, WCYpodcast.com. Click on Support the Show and check out your various options. Next week, we'll be back. We'll have another Masonic Mythbusters for you, as well as some great content. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
WCY Media.
Z-A-S-H-R-O-P.